Welcome to I'm Spiritual, Dammit. I'm your host, Jennifer Weigel. And joining me over the phone, Dr. Jeffrey Long. Now, Jeffrey is the founder of the Near Death Experience Research Foundation. You can find that at nderf.org. He's also the author of Evidence of the Afterlife and God in the Afterlife. Please welcome Dr. Jeffrey Long. Thanks for being on the program.
Jen, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, we were just chatting before we started recording a little bit about our journey and how we got here. Mine started mainly because of losing loved ones. And when you watch someone, you know, die in front of you, you start to wonder, where are they and what's going on? And for me, as a journalist, I wanted to see if I could get some answers to help people who are going through the grieving process. But tell the audience, Jeffrey, why you started down this pathway. Because for you, you're a radiation oncologist. You're also a researcher and a scientist and an author. But, you know, your day job is an MD and an oncologist. So why take the near-death experience route?
Well, certainly, as a radiation oncology physician, many of my patients are struggling with life-threatening illnesses. And, of course, I've asked myself those, they call it, say, big questions many times. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens next when a patient dies? Is that the end? But my interest actually began over a quarter century ago when I was going through one of the more prestigious medical journals in the world, the Journal of the American Medical Association, looking for a cancer article as part of my specialty training. Totally by accident, I found an article that had the term near-death experience in it. And I paused. I'd never heard of that before. I mean, either dead or alive. So what's that all about? Read the article and was immediately fascinated. Here were people describing experiences that seemed strikingly similar all around the world at a time when a conscious experience should be impossible. I knew that from all of my medical training. I vowed right on the spot, you know, I need to do more research on this someday myself. I set up the research website and, well, the rest is history.
The rest is history. I recently interviewed Dr. Penny Sartori, who wrote the book, The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences, out of the UK. And she worked as a nurse for 17 years. She was intensive care and compiled a lot of research as well. And she says that she now believes that consciousness is not actually in the brain. It kind of uses the brain, it kind of goes through the brain, but it obviously comes from a different source. Do you agree with that theory?
Yeah, I know Penny Sartori personally. She's a great researcher, and she, as other near-death experience researchers, have all come to the same conclusion that our consciousness is much more than what resides in our physical brain. Our physical brain may die, but our consciousness, who we are, what we are, and actually all that we are, survives bodily death. There's consciousness that seems to be related to and intimately connected with our physical brain, but that's the exciting part of near-death experience research, is the conclusion based on evidence that we're much more than our physical brain.
I interviewed a gentleman named Daniel Drayson is his name, and he's a filmmaker and a researcher who studies EVP, electronic voice phenomenon, and other things. And he says he hopes he sees it in his lifetime, but that he believes that we're sort of hitting this turning point, that the pendulum is starting to swing in the direction that goes from people who completely don't acknowledge this as possible to the other camp of having so much evidence that we can't deny it anymore. We can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I love that analogy. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's true. There's no doubt about it. As time goes on, we're getting more and more evidence that near-death experiences are, in a word, real. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that evidence comes from those of us doing research. But in addition to that, we're now at a time where near-death experience has been more understood and accepted by the general public as real than ever before in history. So I think more people are sharing their experiences with others. More people are having the opportunity to hear near-death experiences first person. And I think that's one of the strongest weapons we have moving forward to help convince the world of the reality of near-death experience.
So what about your practice as an oncologist? How has all this research changed how you approach your patients?
Enormously. Mm-hmm. Doing this research and understanding some of the core messages of near-death experience, the importance of love, compassion, reaching out to others, decreased materialism, all values that near-death experiencers have, or at least a great majority do, when they come to understand their experience, those are certainly the same kind of values I have adopted as I've done my research. Now, I face every day patients with life-threatening illnesses, Some don't make it. Some, unfortunately, die from their cancer that I try to so heroically to fight. Knowing about near-death experiences has helped me to be a better physician. I can help my patients to face cancer with greater courage and with greater understanding that even if they die, it's not really the end, that the loved ones that we think we've all lost in our earthly life, we are going to be reunited and in full health. And that's a very consistent message of near-death experiences.
You know, there's a physician named Dr. Scott Kolbaba who wrote a book called Physicians Untold Stories, and he's been on the program, and he said the more doctors, you know, and just regular docs, not those that are already in the integrative medicine space, but those that aren't, you know, whether they're family physicians or orthopedic surgeons or OBGYNs or what have you, the more doctors that come out with these experiences and talk about the things that they know to be true just from their day-to-day grind, the more common it will be and the less terrifying it will be. And you've even admitted that when, you know, before your work came out, there was some concern before publishing on how it would be received. And now you're very pleasantly surprised as to how it's being received. Is that still the case?
Oh, absolutely, Jen. Mm-hmm. There's more acceptance of my work among physicians than ever before. I've actually talked at large university medical centers, grand rounds, they call it, mm-hmm. had hundreds of people come. I've talked to other medical groups, both formally and informally now, many, many times, literally having reached hundreds of physicians over the years. I am astounded at what a high percentage of people in the physician community hear what I have to say, the lines of evidence, and get it. And they say, yeah, as a doctor, I know when you've coded, when you've lost consciousness, well, by the very definition of unconscious means you cannot have a conscious experience, and yet here are these patients around the world, undoubtedly by the millions, that are so close to death that they have no physical consciousness, seemingly no sensory awareness, and yet at that moment, when any kind of memory should be impossible, 10 to 20% are having near-death experiences.
And what about those scientists that just say it's a lack of oxygen and that's why the hallucinations are happening? I mean, that, to me, what you just said there is so much more scientifically based than someone saying, oh, they've been out of oxygen, they must be hallucinating.
Yeah, and I think that's why physicians that work with people that lack oxygen going to the brain, medically called hypoxia or anoxia, lack of oxygen going to the brain, we see that as physicians. We know that as patients get more and more hypoxic, as the oxygen is cut down to the brain through vascular or pulmonary problems, that the patient becomes less and less conscious, less and less lucid. That's where, you know, they get more and more close to not having an ability to talk. And then finally, when they reach that point where the oxygen cuts off, people go not they're beyond unconscious. They're literally in a coma. No brainstem reflexes, no detectable activity of the brain at all. So I think it's we doctors that actually see some of these so-called skeptic arguments, and especially hypoxia. We all know how bogus that is.
Mm-hmm. You talk about 277 studies where God was actually encountered in God in the afterlife. And what would you describe God to be? Obviously, very many people have a variety of how they experience this life force. But what would you say was the majority of those experiences in referring to what, quote, God is?
Yeah, great question. In my research, if people that shared their near-death experience used the term God for what they countered and very explicitly during their near-death experience, not their construction of God before their experience or what they thought of later, but this only direct encounters during near-death experience when they were generally physically unconscious or clinically dead. So of the 277 near-death experiencers that described God, there was some fairly significant consistency. Now, appearance is variable. Mm-hmm. There would be people that were either aware of God, heard God, probably most of them actually saw God. God in near-death experiences is quite variable. The most common thing is a brilliant, unearthly light. Mm-hmm. Doesn't hurt their, if you will, vision apparatus during the near-death experience. And often the light of God is associated with a profound, accepting, loving feeling from God. They feel more loved and accepted than they have any time during their earthly life by far. So it's sort of a combination of circumstances in which they describe God. But the sort of the light, the sense of that profound loving and awareness, even connection, compassion from God, and acceptance of who they are, what they are, and for everything they are some of the most common elements that I've heard described about God.
We've heard descriptions that there is really technically no hell, but there's this life review, which could be hellacious, depending on how you lived your life, where you see everything that you put out and you feel everything that you put out to others, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. Are you a believer of that as well, that you don't necessarily believe in a fiery inferno or judgment, you know, somebody with a pitchfork or a clipboard, but just sort of that that we judge ourselves more than anything, and we have to live through that process and feel, you know, sort of like the repercussions of our actions?
Yeah, certainly you're describing what's commonly seen in near-death experience as the life review. Mm-hmm. You may see part or at times even all of your prior life. Mm-hmm. There's typically no external judgment, even if there's other beings around. You have to judge yourself for the, if you will, the good and the not-so-good, loving and the unloving actions in all of your prior life. And so certainly for people that have had profoundly antisocial lives, well, you can imagine what that experience is like. But when it gets down to a technical hell, I guess one way I like to conceptualize it is, if you believe that we live in a universe of infinite possibilities, and I do, then I think to say something cannot exist in such a universe, well, you're kind of on thin ice. We do have some evidence from near-death experiences. There's been some descriptions of truly hellish realms. There's two ways they're encountered in near-death experiences. Sometimes people see them often at a distance. They're not actually interacting with it, but they may be told or be aware or sense very, very vividly that there is that bastion of evil. Now, interesting in near-death experiences, these hellish realms are very segregated. They're literally not a part of the heavenly realms described in near-death experiences. So when you say, you know, heaven, you know, exists and hell cannot exist within heaven, well, that's exactly what near-death experiencers are describing. We do have a few near-death experiences that had some direct observations of hell. It seems to be people that have made some very, very poor choices and a whole multitude of them, and the beings there, the demonic beings, seem to be more comfortable with other beings like themselves that share that values. Interestingly, there's often a sense that these people could choose to leave that hellish realm, but again, as we just said, in the heavenly realm, you're known for who you are, what you are, and everything you are. And if you've lived a very, very antisocial life, well, that's going to be immediately and instantly known by all other beings there. And that may be why people choose to stay in the very darkest realms in the afterlife. No, by the way, and I'll add very importantly, there's no near-death experience researcher that I'm aware of that believes that there's a permanent involuntary hell. That's an important point. I think these people chose to get themselves there in the afterlife, and they have every possibility and, in fact, a desire from all the other beings to make that choice to leave that hellish realm and return to their true home, that being the blissful, if you will, heavenly realms so commonly described in near-death experiences.
In your research, do you have a belief that not only are we trying to evolve here on this side, but when we get to the other side, are the spirits on the other side also trying to evolve? Like, the work isn't finished. We probably still have some homework to do when we get there.
Oh, no doubt about that. We are beings. We're on a journey in this. Literally, our earthly journey is just a part of our very tiniest slice, if you will, of our eternal journey.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt that in the afterlife, there's beings that seem to be gradations of spiritual evolvement, if you will. I mean, there's some that are seem to be much more spiritually evolved, enlightened. Near-death experiencers report a greater sense of love from those beings and from others. So I think we're just literally spiritual beings having an earthly existence, and we've got a lot to learn here. Our earthly life is extremely important as part of that quest. And I think that quest will continue even after we've left our earthly life. So it's an adventure, literally, that will last a lifetime and beyond.
In your research, have you had any people who've been in comas or near death and in the light and then come back and their illness has disappeared, such as Anita Morjani, famously for her book Dying to Be Me? And she talked about her experience with 24 tumors, some the size of lemons, and cancer everywhere. But when she got into the light and had this understanding that a lot of her illness was caused through her fears. I mean, there were obviously other factors, but mainly her fears were kind of ruling her life. And then she comes back and she's cancer-free. Are you a believer, because you're a medical, obviously a professional in the medical community, are you a believer that our belief systems can affect our health so severely?
Oh, absolutely. I know Anita personally, mm-hmm. and I know of her medical history. We've talked at great length with Anita.
Yes.
And I can tell you, as a physician that treats cancer, what she had as a result of her near-death experience is medically inexplicable. The proper term is miracle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was literally on death's door. She was, I mean, they were talking about very, very limited life expectancy because she had such overwhelmingly advanced disease. And here she was, had her near-death experience, and remarkably, they drew some blood, and she knew if she chose to return to earthly life, it would come back and show she was getting better. And if she chose to stay in that beautiful, blissful, heavenly realm, the blood test would show she was worsening. Now, we have not a huge number, but certainly some other experiences that where they, during their near-death experience, became aware that they would be healed of terminal illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, again, even looking at it with a very cautious eye from a physician, I'm left with no word to describe some of the healing associated with near-death experiences as miracles.
That's right. And so when you have the case, here it is. This is miraculous. There is no scientific explanation for what happened to Anita. I mean, it's just, and to be cancer-free today, all these years later, which she still is really, truly miraculous. And so some people look at that and go, that's incredible. And then some people will look at their sick, dying loved one and say, why me, right? What is your belief, because you've been in this world and so many thousands of cases now, especially with NDERF.org, the community is always sharing and comparing notes and so forth. Do you believe there's a wrong place at a wrong time, or is there destiny? I mean, just in a spiritual sense, what are some of your beliefs?
Yeah, and that's a real good one. A great question here. Okay, we've got Anita and some very rare selected other people that are cured miraculously of a terminal illness. And of course, the obvious question, Jen, that so many are going to have is, why didn't it happen to my loved one? Why mm-hmm. didn't it happen to my grandfather, my grandmother, spouses, friends, family, loved ones? Well, I think one of the most direct responses to that, and really a core part of my spiritual being and understanding about what's going on during near-death experiences, came interestingly directly from a near-death experiencer who was in a heavenly realm, incredibly blissful, mm-hmm. peaceful experience, love everywhere, and she was literally in the presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
This near-death experiencer asked God directly, why me? Why was I allowed to have such an amazing experience? I think God answers, and his answer, I think, extends to all of us. And the answer was, love falls on everyone equally.
Mm-hmm.
This is what you needed to live your earthly life.
Mm.
That, I think, touches out to a wisdom as to so many times why some of us are miraculously cured and the overwhelming majority of us are not when we face terminal illnesses. Again, and I think the other real critical point is our earthly life is the tiniest slice of our real earthly existence. Who we are, what we are, our destiny, our heritage is that afterlife where we're reunited with everyone that we've ever loved forever.
That's incredible. And you also talk a lot about Vicky, the blind woman who comes in her near-death experience, has a 360-degree vision. And this is a woman who thought then when she came back from her NDE, thought that everybody could see 360. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, that was fun. I've interviewed Vicky in person, and I had a long discussion about our pie-shaped visual fields that you, I, and virtually everybody experiences in her earthly life, and Vicky literally thought I was kidding, making it up. She thought it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And why would your vision be so limited? Because for the only experience Vicky had, and I would add, she was born totally blind
mm-hmm.
and only knew vision from her near-death experience, and you're right, it was 360-degree, actually spherical vision. We see that a fair amount in near-death experiences, people that have vision that is absolutely unearthly mm-hmm. in that spherical ability. I mean, they literally see forward, backward, right, left, up, down, and they're processing all that visual information instantaneously and completely. So just another one of the myriad of lines of evidence that near-death experiences are what virtually everyone who's had a near-death experience believes, and that is they're real.
One of the things that shifted for me after talking with Dr. Mary Neal of Heaven and Back, right, the orthopedic surgeon who was in the light and was without oxygen for about 30 minutes, and she said when she was up there, she could see that we were all connected, and she was told that it's sort of like a big giant oriental rug, right? There's light and there's dark, but we're all part of the same carpet. We're part of the same tapestry, and we need the light and we need the dark to be complete. But down here, it feels like, oh, shoot, I'm getting snagged. I'm getting stepped on. This is awful. Woe is me. But up there, it's beautiful from the bird's eye view. You know, in this current climate where everybody is saying, I am not like you, and you're just so crazy over there, and how could you believe in this and that? You know, I think it's really hard to get that sort of 360-degree vision, right? That we are all in this together. We are all connected, and that we are all part of this big, bright, creating light that made all these different shapes and sizes. Isn't that the case?
Oh, it really absolutely is. And one of the key things that Mary Neal said that I see over and over in near-death experiences is that very powerful awareness mm-hmm. that, and I've looked carefully at how it's expressed in near-death experiences. Typically, they use a stronger word than connection, and more often the word used is unity. But, Jen, I was so intrigued by that, I actually put that in my survey of near-death experiences.
Mm.
But here's the results I had. Here's what the latest version of the survey, 596 near-death experiencers, said when I asked them directly, during your experience, did you encounter any specific information or awareness that a mystical universal connection or unity, oneness, exists?
Mm-hmm.
Straight up, what about that mystical connection, unity, oneness? Astoundingly, 47.1% said yes.
Mm-hmm.
11% said no, and only 42%, 11% said uncertain, and 42% said no. So there you have it. An astounding nearly 50% of near-death experiencers have that awareness that we literally don't have, virtually any of us, in our earthly life. We really are one. We're connected. We're all a part of each other. We're all literally having that unity, which we can't perceive in our earthly life, but becomes so obvious during near-death experiences and other mystical experiences.
And for those who've had the NDE, they're lucky in the sense that the memory of it is so completely vivid. I mean, that's one of the things Anita and Mary both expressed, is that it feels just as vivid as if it happened yesterday or 5 minutes ago. It hasn't faded. It hasn't faded away. It's not, oh, shoot, I can't remember that part. Every part is completely solid in their memory and engraved. That's one of the, I think, the through lines of a lot of people who have NDEs. Wouldn't you say that's the case as well in your research?
Oh, I see this routinely.
Mm-hmm.
It is very typical that people will say something to the effect of, I don't remember what I had for breakfast 2 weeks ago, but my near-death experience I had 20 years ago is as clear as in my mind as if it just happened.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, both prospective and retrospective near-death experience studies confirm that this seems to be a very special kind of memory. One person interviewed near-death experiencers and then interviewed them again up to 8 years later, and per my communication with them, their experiences were shared verbatim, word for word. And then another retrospective study, they were out to around 15 years after the near-death experience, and they took a survey instrument, and again, there was absolutely no indication that the experiences were either embellished, that means details added, or forgotten, meaning that details were forgotten, even out well over a decade. So near-death experiences are not like a typical life event. They're the memory that literally can last a lifetime.
Mm. When my father was fighting brain cancer, they had stopped the chemo and radiation because of worry that it would affect so much cognitively based on where the tumors were. So we started alternative therapies, and we found somebody in the Chicago area who did this Qigong work. And I had been familiar with Reiki, but I hadn't been totally versed in Qigong. So we go to this integrative medicine part of a hospital here in Chicago, and my father goes in and he sits down, and we're not really quite sure what Dr. Zhou did, and he didn't speak very good English at all. But we know that when we came out of there, my father's clarity and his centeredness, it was as if he had just gone on a meditation retreat for 3 weeks. It was so crystal clear. And I remember very clearly one day after that, I'm scrambling in my brain thinking, what else can we do? How can we stop these tumors? My pretending to be a doctor person, right? I'm thinking, who can I call? What else? What other therapies? What, you know, carrot juice can we get that has the magic potion that's going to get rid of this brain tumor? And he says, you know, Jen, it doesn't matter. I can't read or write or play the piano. Heck, I can't even drive. All the things I used to love to do. But it doesn't matter because I can still love. And love is all that matters.
Oh, wow. That is profound. Thanks for sharing that.
It was really powerful. And at the time, I was like, yeah, whatever. Keep talking, buddy. I've got to find a solution here. But that was the solution. He was tapped into something greater than. And in all of your interviews, I mean, and all the people who've died and lived to talk about it, that big through line of only love connects us all is pretty much prominent, isn't it?
Yeah, no question about that. Mm-hmm. That's the number one thing. The two most common words, Jen, that are used in describing a near-death experience are peace and love. Mm-hmm. There seems to be that love, that connection, that unity that we're all a part of. We can't perceive that in earthly life, hardly ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, in our day-to-day life, we have conflicts, deadlines, we have commitments, and it's difficult, but it is just heartening. And even the busiest of days, I can always go through the day with just a little bit more of a sparkle in my eye, knowing that at the end of my life, at the end of the road, we're going to have an environment where there is no misery, where there is no difficulties, where there's love overwhelmingly far beyond anything that we knew on earth, and that is literally the heritage of each and every one of us, and that's exciting.
But also at the same token, some people might say, oh, okay, well, if that's the case, I'm just going to check out early because this world is awful.
So
in your research and maybe just in your belief systems, what are your thoughts on suicide and that if you I know that a lot of people have different belief systems about this, but it's not like you can just cash it all in and say, okay, I'm rid of all my problems. Sure, you'll be in the unconditional love of the light, but there are still lessons to be learned whether you're over there or you're over here. So the bills might be gone, but there's still now all these different lessons that you have to go through on the other side as well.
Yeah, here's some of the best evidence in response to the concern about suicide as an effort to have a near-death experience and perhaps become enlightened in that way. One very famous near-death experience researcher actually studied near-death experiences that resulted from suicide attempts, mm-hmm. and actually a pretty large number of them. And almost uniformly, when people recovered from their suicide attempt, they understood that their suicide attempt was wrong, that their earthly life was much more meaningful and purposeful than they'd ever thought before, and they realized that what a huge mistake they'd made in attempting suicide. And in fact, it's very common for people that attempt suicide once to attempt again and again and again. But for those that attempted suicide, had a near-death experience, almost none of them will ever attempt suicide again because they know that's not the way out. Mm-hmm. They know that's not the right thing to do. I actually have very stern warnings with that very same concept in both of my books and on the NDE website, because I think it's very important for people to know you can't shortcut our earthly life. It may be painful, difficult, it is for all of us, but we're here for a reason, and mm-hmm. it's important no matter how hard the journey seems.
Just thank you for stressing that. And so for anyone who's listening now who's going through a tough time, our loved ones on the other side can send us signs and signals. What would you recommend? And this is kind of wild to be asking an oncologist, but what would you recommend our listeners do to try to tap into that greater source that all of your research patients have been exposed to?
Yeah, that's interesting. I asked point blank in a survey question, is there any earthly life experience that reproduced any part of your near-death experience? And really, the answers are all over the board. There seems to be, people seem to, over time, develop that wisdom to know how to connect with that one, that unity, to sort of become aware of that afterlife. At least I think most people can if they work at it. Having another near-death experience is probably the most commonly thing listed. Right up there, meditation, mm-hmm. Very, very common, nature experiences. Just setting some time to really be aware that such connections are possible and be open to them in life experiences and life circumstances certainly will lead people to be aware of what they previously would have thought was an unusual event. With spiritual eyes open, they may realize that it's a serendipitous event, absolutely not possible, and it can help, if you will, be a light along their earthly path.
Mm. And for you, how do you start your day, Jeffrey, and end your day? Do you have a practice, a meditation? Do you and your wife have certain ceremonies that kind of get you back to Control-Alt-Delete?
Yeah, I've got such a profoundly busy life, Jen.
Yeah.
I would be the first to admit that it's hard for me to really have a ritual like that is done at a specific time. I think I find, sort of my spiritual centering and actually doing what I do just about every day, which is reading the near-death experience accounts shared with us and other mm-hmm. spiritual accounts, thinking about them, writing my notes, working with my wife, Jody, and posting them. So that seems to be, if you will, my ongoing centering. And it's actually been such a powerful experience in my life that I've come to believe the greatest teachers in my life aren't necessarily the doctors that have taught me so much about my medical specialty of radiation oncology, but some of my greatest teachers are actually people from every walk of life mm-hmm. that had that exceptional experience, a near-death experience, and then had the courage to share it. I've learned so much over the years.
Give us an example for the audience, Dr. Long, about a few of the cases that you've just, you know, put away. Just a recent, maybe something that's fresh on your brain that you have recently just sort of documented.
Sure. I was sitting here thinking about how I was going to give a workshop at an upcoming March conference that I'm going to be giving, and also a keynote address there. And it's mm-hmm. like, what can I possibly do, Jen, that would really be of most meaning and most significance from all the literally over 4,000 near-death experiences that I reviewed and are posted on the website? You know, how do you condense that down even in a couple of hours? And while I was reflecting on that seeming lofty task, literally, I mean, within hours, the very next experience I got was a near-death experience that just had some of the most profound lessons and comments about love that, you know, just absolutely said, I get it, thank you, universe. You know, that's what I really need to focus on, because that's where so many of the near-death experiences point to as being the most common thing we need to think about in our earthly life. Not only how profoundly we are loved, but how important love is that we need to express throughout our earthly life. So that one hit me just real directly. But shoot, Jen, you know, I really appreciate everybody that shares these near-death experiences, no matter how little or how large. Mm-hmm. It's almost like I take a little nugget of wisdom, like a little piece of heaven, from everyone that I read of these near-death experiences.
Any difference between the children's and the adults in your research that you note that you want to share with our listeners?
In some ways, yes. You know, as far as just the elements of the near-death experience, out-of-body, tunnel, mm-hmm. intense emotions, you know, life review, as far as those specific elements, and actually studied that and published that in my first book, mm-hmm. there's really strikingly little difference that children have. They may be a little bit, in some of my later research, I'm wondering, they may be a little bit less likely to have a life review, but by and large, the similarity of the elements of their experience are far more striking than dissimilar. However, mm-hmm. when you read deeper, especially the very young children's, there certainly are differences. Now, interestingly, even very small children, we're talking down about 3, 4, 5-year-olds, very often they describe thinking, processing information vastly better than their chronological age on Earth would suggest. Mm-hmm. I mean, they go through the near-death experience, they're thinking very quickly, they have that acceleration of consciousness that's so commonly reported. For the very, very young children, they may be often there's some guardian angels that may be with them, and there seems to be some people that sort of are there just like their parents would, and sort of recapitulate all that they're familiar with earthly for the, you know, for getting down to the very, very young children. So in a way, they're similar, and in a way, they're somewhat different.
As you know, PMH Atwater doing a lot of research with children and their near-death experiences, and I shared this with Penny, and I'll share it with you as well. She told me that when she interviewed many children who said that they could actually, when they were in the light, they could see a heartfelt prayer going from the person saying the prayer to the recipient in the shape of a rainbow-colored light going from their heart to the recipient. So
that's really striking, and I've had other near-death experience accounts, children and adults, where they can literally see prayers on Earth reaching up as light towards others, and that's just, it's so beautiful, mm-hmm. It's so profound, and it really helps me to understand. You know, we worry if our prayers are answered. I can tell you, based on near-death experience evidence, each and every one of our prayers are heard. They may not be answered the way we think they're going to be, but absolutely, every thought, every prayer that we've ever had in our life, they're aware of it on the other side.
Absolutely. And so in all of these interviews that you've conducted, and such an incredible resource for anybody curious about this, NDERF.org, what do you think you know for sure, Dr. Long?
Sure. What I know for sure is that there is an afterlife, and it's a wonderful afterlife, and it's for all of us. Mm-hmm. I know that who we are, what we are, our consciousness, our memories, our personalities will be extended beyond our physical death on Earth, and it will be an important part of our, if you will, greater reality in the afterlife. That I am absolutely certain on, based on many, many lines of evidence, and actually having debated that with people that opposed that idea mm-hmm. and never lost a debate, I might add. So there's that is one thing I know for sure. I think that, and another thing I know for sure, there is a God on that other side, an overwhelmingly loving, compassionate God that loves each and every one of us, stunningly non-judgmental or angry or wrathful. I literally haven't encountered that essentially ever in my research. So there seems to be that greater intelligence on the other side, that greater love, that greater compassion. And it's a part of what we really are, and it lies ahead for each one of us as we continue our spiritual journey beyond even our earthly life. I know that, again, based on literally over 4,000 near-death experiences and vast numbers of other similar spiritual experiences. That is absolutely, in fact, there's far more evidence for what I just shared there about the reality of afterlife. That's a much stronger line of evidence than the line of evidence we use to make life and death decisions about cancer we treat.
Interesting, right? And I say this to people all the time. Over 250 million people believe that Jesus came back from the dead and appeared to Mary, yet there was no technical evidence, right? It was just stories passed down by generation to generation, word of mouth. There was no EVP recording. There was no video camera. There was no typewriter. They were chiseling things down onto templates. So, you know, for us now to have all of this evidence that we have, like you have, all this data, how can people doubt the data?
Yeah, and that's really a good question. Like I said, I've debated some people that quibbled with my research finding. They were nearly always atheists, mm-hmm. and I've never lost a battle. never lost a debate.
And what do you tell them? I mean, what are the come of the, like? I have a few atheists in my family and some born again Christians that think I'm going straight to hell. So, what do I tell them? Help me, Dr. Long.
Okay, sure. We just talked about Vicky Early, born totally blind.
Yeah,
and then she's suddenly unconscious after a car accident, and the first time she has vision in her life while she's unconscious. While physically totally blind, and there she is with this stunning 360-degree vision.
Right.
The near-death experiences in the blind, and I'm now developing a series of them. We're asking directly about earthly vision and vision during near-death experiences. We now have a series of people who are blind that had stunningly crystal-clear vision during their near-death experience. So literally the blind are seeing. Interestingly, we actually have a person who was born totally deaf that was able to understand communication without, obviously any auditory physical life. But beyond that, some people, and certainly this works for the physicians, if your heart stops, Jen, within 10 to 20 seconds, measurable brain activity measured by the EEG or electroencephalogram goes absolutely flat. Mm-hmm. So when you have a cardiac arrest, within 10 to 20 seconds, you've got nothing measurable in the brain and you cannot possibly have a lucid, organized experience. Same thing with general anesthesia. When you're under that blanket of sleep, you cannot possibly have any remembrance, a lucid, organized memory during that time, during adequate general anesthesia. Well, I now have scores of people who are under, by every account, adequate general anesthesia, and their heart stopped. They had a complication of the anesthesia, surgery, or the underlying illness or trauma that led to the general surgery in the first place. Their heart stops while they're under general anesthesia. That should be, by a materialist perspective, absolutely doubly impossible for them to have any memory at that time. And yet, they have typical near-death experiences, stunningly visual, all the bells and whistles, all the elements, including often observations of their own frantic resuscitation efforts right in the operating room. And I might add, what they observe is not like what that you would have believed from your Hollywood or television shows, especially if it's, and it typically is, unexpected. There's a lot of franticness. The crash cart doesn't mystically appear. There can be unprofessional behavior, and gosh, Jen, I hate to say it, it's usually the doctors.
Right.
And, it's nothing like what you see on TV, and yet that is very vividly what very large numbers of near-death experiencers describe, and that's what really happens when you code in the operating room.
So Dr. Raymond Moody shared a story with me, because a lot of the doctors will say, oh, it's a lack of oxygen in the brain, blah, blah, blah. But he has this very compelling case where he says an Italian doctor shared the story with him that somebody coded, a very young, fit guy, coded in a sort of standard procedure, and they're freaking out, trying to resuscitate him. It's not working. So finally, they're going to call it. Well, as soon as they called it, all this ruckus and this chaos, and the wife forces her way back into the operating room and says, don't stop. My husband just came to me in the waiting room and he's screaming at me that he's not dead yet. You got to try some more.
So, wow.
So they were like, well, okay. So they go back, they work and they work, and the guy comes back and he says to the doctors, I was trying to tell you it wasn't my time, but you weren't listening. So I had to go out to the lobby and get my wife in here.
That's awesome. Yeah, and that happens. I think, and actually we too have scores of experiences that have that consciousness that not only separates the body from what we call an out-of-body experience during a near-death experience, mm-hmm. but they can have observations far from their physical body. In fact, we had on television once someone who coded in the operating room under general anesthesia. Their consciousness went down to the cafeteria where they saw and heard their family, unaware of what was going on up in the OR because it was just happening, mm-hmm. Came back and vividly described exactly what they were saying and doing and eating while they were coded under general anesthesia in a different part of the hospital.
Yeah.
So that's an astounding single experience, but by the time you have scores of these types of experiences, almost uniformly accurate, close to 100% accurate in observations down to the finest details, like Raymond Moody's mm-hmm. Remarkable account there, you really have to understand that the only possible explanation is that consciousness absolutely can exist and exist vividly apart from the physical body and even very far from the physical body.
Right. Location doesn't matter. I had another gentleman telling me of his near-death experience where he went to his brother's garden in Las Vegas and saw him planting these things and doing this and doing that, and then he came out of the coma and said to his brother, who didn't believe in any of this, so here's what you were doing on Tuesday.
I love NDEs like that. I've got a whole bunch. Hey, Jen, we had one too relatively recently shared. It was in Iran, and it was the guy coded mm-hmm. Due to an illness, and his consciousness left his body and went to where his wife was and saw vividly on what his wife was doing. She was looking at real estate in Tehran, and they didn't live in Tehran, and he had no idea that there'd never been any discussion about going there, and he had no idea what that was all about. So when he recovered from that close brush with death, you know where this is going. He goes to his wife and says, what's that all about? And his wife said, amazed, said, you know what, I offered another job. We'd have to move. We would have to go to Tehran. And I was just checking what the real estate would be what it would be like if we moved. And you're right, that's exactly what I was doing at that time.
Wow, that's great. So, we just don't have all the answers. I mean, I mention this a lot, but there are commercials on TV with doctors lighting up saying, what cigarette do you smoke? In 1949, 9 out of 10 doctors smoke Camels. So we just do what we know at the time based on the research that we have. And we have to continually gather data so that we can change our belief systems based on the facts. And so I am incredibly grateful to everything that you do and anyone in your field, as well as your wife helping you keep the site going. And for anybody listening that hasn't noodled around, I suggest you go there immediately, nderf.org, or you can go on Amazon and get Dr. Long's books, Evidence of the Afterlife, God in the Afterlife. And please tell me you're working on another book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is so fascinating. I'm continuing to get more and more lines of evidence for the reality of near-death experience. I'm a couple years away from retirement, but when I retire, I'm absolutely going to be going absolutely full tilt mm-hmm. on writing up a third and hopefully fourth book. So I've got lots of other things to share. Not a surprise, given that I have over 4,000 near-death experiences posted on that nderf.org website, all of which answered a very, very detailed questionnaire. So given the volume of information we have and as remarkable as it is, stay tuned. We got books coming up in the future.
I love it. Okay, and Stay Tuned is the name of my first book, so I knew we were meant to talk.
That's great. Great minds think alike.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much, Jeffrey, for being on the program and for all that you do. And I hope that we can continue the dialogue. And when those other books are out, let's make sure that we talk again, if not sooner. How does that sound?
Absolutely, Jen. Thank you so much. Fantastic interview here today. And very much look forward to talking again when those books come out with whole new vistas on some of the remarkable issues of consciousness and spirituality.
Absolutely. NDERF.org is where all of you listeners can find out more about Dr. Jeffrey Long and his research. And I'm Jen Weigel at JENWEIGEL.com. I hope everybody out there stays spiritual, and we'll talk with you next time.